Thank you for listening to the sermon podcast from Grace Anglican Church of Grove City, Pennsylvania. Our goal in every sermon is to proclaim the bold truth of the Word of God, especially the undiluted grace of Jesus Christ. If you want to learn more about our church, check out our website at graceanglicanonline.com.
One man come in the name of love. One man come and go.
Is a Monty Python comedy from 1979, and as many of you know, the film portrays a first century Jewish man named Brian who was misunderstood to be the Messiah. At the end of the film, a group of 100 or so crucified men, including Brian, begin to sing in unison a song entitled, "Always Look on the Bright Side of Life." It was a ridiculous moment of corporate widespread denial. As they're all dying, they're engaging in this moment of silly, ridiculous optimism. And I think that is deliberately the last scene in the film. I think it's planned. I think that the mindset behind that portion of the film was intended to send a message about religion in general, that religion in some way is simply a happy distraction, a pleasant mirage to distract us from the inevitable gnawing abyss of mortality. This is certainly what Freud thought about religion. Freud thought religion was wish fulfillment. That is, it's a happy delusion that we paste upon our futures and upon the heavens. It's like existential heroin that keeps us docile and calm. And I simply want to say, whether it's from Monty Python or Sigmund Freud, I think one might be a little bit more intelligent than the other, though my assumption about that differs from day to day, who is more intelligent. Nevertheless, I think that assumption about Christianity is adolescent, unsophisticated, wrong, and stupid. And hopefully my sermon will prove that point. I'd like to speak today about Numbers chapter 21, because this is a story that shows the fathomless depths and rich, raw nature of real religion. Real religion, which, by the way, has the power to cure you, has the power to upend sin, has the power to change patterns that have been in your family for generations. There is so much wisdom contained in this story. I can't possibly exhume it all, but I'll do my best. And I'd like to walk through this passage verse by verse with you until we arrive at the uncanny cure that it presents all of us. So it begins with a contextual phrase that I'll read. From Mount Hor, they set out by the way to the Red Sea to go around the land of Edom. Now, to give you the big picture context, they have recently, the Jews that is, have left Egypt where they were enslaved for hundreds of years, and they are in process. They're in process of gaining a new territory, a new homeland that we know as the Promised Land, that reservoir of milk and honey, that place that's like a new Eden that has a paradisal quality to it. They're not there yet, though. They're in the midst of a wilderness territory that, by the way, isn't just the desert. It's desert that's occupied by other empires, pagan empires, very often hostile empires like Edom. And so the Jews are transitioning from Egyptian captivity through this desert wasteland that's often occupied until they get to the Promised Land, but they're not there yet. And while they're in the wilderness, they are, from time to time, experiencing a rough life. And whenever you are in a transitional moment, that is, maybe you're in process of moving, or you're going to a new grad program, or you're getting a new job, you know how difficult this can be, how everything is upended when you've moved to a different location, you're getting to know a new zip code. And just think about how rough it would have been for them. They have no steady sources of income. They have no daily routine that's consistent. They don't own a home. They don't have a living room. They don't have their favorite restaurants. They have no parks nearby. There are no markets. And the terrain is changing day by day because they're moving day by day. This is a very difficult period of time for these people. It's a place, the wilderness is a place of neediness, of insecurity, and of unpredictability, where you are laid bare before the elements, and they are in process of learning to trust Yahweh and his emissary Moses to lead them from captivity into this more heavenly state within the promised land. This is quite a difficult sojourn. And so that's the context. That's the place in which we find ourselves. And then I'll continue in verse 2. And the people became impatient on the way. And the people spoke against God and against Moses. Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no food and no water, and we loathe this worthless food. By the way, don't you love that line? There's no food, and we hate the food. right? Because there's no, you know, they can't shoot deer exactly, because it's, you know, there may be empires there, but this is still the desert. There's not a lot of, you know, natural life they could kill and eat. And so God is giving them day by day this bread substance that we know as manna, and they're getting a little sick of the diet. They want some variety. They want some Thai food, but there's no Thai food nearby. And so they're getting sick. They're getting bitter. And notice that while Israel is not in the midst of an acute crisis, because God has provided for them every step of the way, not just in terms of daily sustenance, but in terms of his immediacy. Remember what leads them, after all. Pillar of fire by night, pillar of cloud by the day. They are completely taken care of. All of their needs are being met, and they're being brought out of tyranny into liberty. At the same time, while they're not in an acute crisis, Israel creates their own crisis, and we do this all the time. All the time. They create their own crisis. It begins in the heart. It ends in the lips. What's the crisis of the heart? Impatience. How long do we have to suffer through all of these unknowns, all of these questions, all of this rough terrain, all of this time where we're sleeping on the ground in the desert? I mean, how many nights do we have to deal with this? So it begins with a sense of impatience, and then they begin to articulate, or in a way, incarnate their rough feelings, their bitterness, their sour spirits. They start grumbling, is the word, grumbling against the Lord and against Moses. and by the way, if you really want to know how you feel in life, give ear to your words, because your words will evidence how you really feel. Your words are the exhaust vent of your heart. And that's one way to get to know what's really going on inside. Anyway, they speak against God and against Moses. Notice what they don't do. They don't curse the desert. They don't get introspective and start asking serious questions about their own sin. Instead, they call into question God and Moses, the ones who are providing them with liberation and sustenance. These are the ones who have actually helped them to become free people, and yet they're getting saddled with the blame. And so the people are speaking against their sources of liberation and provision, and note what they say against God and against Moses. Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? It's interesting. Many times within the Exodus narrative, the people of Israel want to return to slavery. They want to go back. They miss the food. They miss the predictability. Now, we might think that's crazy, but when you're in the middle of a wilderness time in your life, when everything is being called into question and you don't have stability and predictability, sometimes it is very easy to long for times in your life that, yes, were brutal, but at least you knew what was coming down the pike. You knew what to expect. And so they long for the place, yes, the place of tyranny that at least involved a little predictability and stability. By the way, you may know of battered women who have, for whatever reason that you can't fathom, stayed with an abusive husband, which I think is very dangerous for them to do that. When you talk to them, you might begin to understand that they don't know what life would be like, where the money would come from, how they would survive if they dislodged themselves from this tyrannical menace. So they don't know how to live. They don't know what life would be like, especially if they've been gaslit by this abusive tyrant for a long time. And so they stick with the abusive tyrant because the thought is the devil I know might be better than the devil I don't know. Now, often that's not the case, but it feels that way. And so they stick with the tyranny. And the Jews, God could get them physically out of Egypt, but it was harder to get Egypt out of them. They kept wanting to go back. And so they're angry that they are now they've now been brought into this wilderness context that has made life, according to them, worse rather than better. And so they speak out, and they speak with bitterness. They speak with a grumbling spirit. By the way, if you're ever in a difficult context and you think it's as bad as it can possibly get, oh no, it can get much worse depending on how you engage with it. And you can make any hellish context deeper in the Dante-esque circles of hell through just bad through articulating your negativity, resentment, and spite. You can make hell all the hotter. And that's exactly what's happening here. They're making it worse as they flood the desert with their own resentment. You know, when I was young, I didn't swear very much. When I got older, that changed. But when I was young, my family swore a lot, and I wanted to sort of distance myself from them linguistically by watching my tongue and guarding my tongue. And therefore, I thought I was righteous because I didn't drop the bombs, you know. Yeah, I thought so. Until I had a priest in college say, Ethan, you know, if there's one thing that you need to work on before you go to seminary, you really need to work on your speech. And I'm like, oh, I thought he meant public speaking or something. And he said, no, the words you say. And I'm like, well, I don't cuss. And he said, that's the least of your issues, man. Like, you are so acerbic and critical and sharp with your tongue. Your tongue is like a dagger, and you lead people to bleed, man. And you need to work on that before you become a priest. Best advice ever. You can think that because you don't say certain words that you're above the fray. You ain't. Especially if you use your tongue in an acerbic, horrific, grumbling way, you are a person who is serrated and dangerous. It came home to me in a new way when a friend who was a minister of almost 30 years, he wrote to me about his experience of leadership during COVID. And this is what he said about grumbling during COVID. Really helpful. He says, Dear Eth, by the way, that's what my family calls me. Isn't that terrible? Eth, not Ethan, because that's too hard to say. Just E-E-E-T-H. Yay, Eth. He writes, there are lots of non-recoverables from the COVID years and lots of reasons why I'm currently looking for another vocation. But most of the personal pain was due to the lack of humility and those who made my life infinitely harder, not just for me, but also for my family, and the constant attacks on both my flawed, I'm sure, strategy and character. I did the very best that I could, but for many, my protocols were either too much and I was supposedly duped by liberal deep state interests, and for others, I did not take the most extreme measures and therefore I put the vulnerable at constant risk. I swear on a stack of prayer books that I did the best I could and I was very cautious, but it was never enough because radicals never believe they are radical. Most hurtful of all, there were no apologies from those who flipped out, rage emailed, called to protest, vanished into thin air, stabbed me in the back, gossiped about me, polemicized to deliberately create division in the congregation, weaponized social media against the church, and drew lines in the sand based on their own sense of terror, a terror that often did not fit the moment. I repeat, no apologies, not even one. Why this indefensible silence? Because every grumbler was convinced that their grumbling was on the side of righteousness, so they justified whatever they said and treated everyone else with contempt, a la the Pharisee from Luke 18. I don't think I'll ever recover from what happened during those years, and so for me, it's best to quietly say goodbye to this whole enterprise. Now, maybe you say he's too much of a sensitive soul. Maybe, but you weren't in his position. Grumbling can be an agonizing thing, and everyone in this room has experienced a grumbler. And it has taken more than a pound of flesh, so to speak, at least from your soul. It's been brutal. Well, this is what Moses was facing. People that were constantly berating him, berating his leadership, and then berating the God who was supporting him. And so how does the Lord respond to this? This is verse 6. Then the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people so that many of the people of Israel died. And the people came to Moses and said, "We have sinned, for we have spoken against the Lord and against you. Pray to the Lord that he take away the serpents from us." Now, that's a rough consequence, man. I mean, that's a hard day. And remember, the Jews at this point are under the Sinai covenant or the law covenant. And under that conditional covenant, if you broke the commandments of Yahweh, there was immediate, obvious, and national consequences for your own sin. And notice what God sends to punish them, sends as judgment against them. He doesn't send a virus, which is invisible. He doesn't do what he did to the Egyptians and send gnats or frogs. He doesn't do what he did to Sodom and Gomorrah and send fire from the heavens. No, he sends the worst Old Testament iconography that is possible to send. The serpent, reminiscent of the fall in Genesis 3. The serpent, the dragon, the Leviathan, they're all Old Testament symbols for the most evil of evils. This is the foundation of all evil. God sends serpents to bite them. And one commentator said, it's as if God took their inward, grumbling, biting, venomous, devilish nature, and externalized it to attack them. And that's exactly what's happening. The serpents are sinking their fangs into the people of God, and they're dying. And notice at this point, after they get walloped, or bit rather, they have a quickening. They awaken to the reality that they're at fault, and they ask Moses to say a prayer. Kind of Moses almost as a priestly figure, say a prayer and have us delivered from these snakes, have the snakes go away. But that is not what happens. This is the odd cure that's presented in verse 7. So Moses prayed for the people, and the Lord said to Moses, "Make a fiery serpent and set it on a pole, and everyone who is bitten when he sees it shall live." So Moses made a bronze serpent and set it on a pole, and if a serpent bit anyone, he would look at the bronze serpent and live. Notice what God didn't do in response to Moses' priestly prayer. He didn't, like St. Patrick, chase all the snakes out of Ireland. That didn't happen. The snakes were still around and still biting people. They never left. Nor did God directly heal somebody by providing some invisible mystical antidote that everybody just got better. No, God didn't cure that way. Instead, he ordered the construction of a mediating instrument. A mediating instrument. And if people were to look upon this mediating instrument, this bronze serpent lifted high on a pole, they would not die, but they would be healed from the snake bite. Now, notice, by the way, the placement of this serpent. The bronze serpent is physically exalted, lifted up, not on the ground like the other slithering serpents. It's suspended high in the air so that all eyes can be drawn to it so that everyone can see it. So it's like the other snakes, but it's distinctive in that it hangs between heaven and earth in this mediating position. And this would have been, of course, for Jewish people, doubly repulsive. No one would have ever thought that Yahweh would have commanded something like this. Remember that anything that is reminiscent of idolatry within Judaism is strictly forbidden. And yet, here in the desert, God orchestrates the construction of something that many would have assumed at least looks sort of idol-like, even though it wasn't, this carved thing. And not only is it a carved thing, it's the carved thing of the worst possible thing in the world, this devilish instrument of judgment. And you're carving that and then placing that, lifting it high on a pole. You know, we make artistic renderings of beautiful things in order to exalt the soul. That's why the Sistine Chapel ceiling was painted. That's why Monet's water lilies exist. That's why Van Gogh's sunflowers were created, to exalt something about nature and to lift our hearts a little bit. But this, on the other hand, this is something sickly and deadly that was lifted up. God is saying in Numbers 21, I want you to take a version of judgment, a picture of judgment, stare at the very thing that is killing you, that killed your grandmother, that killed an infant, stare at that very object of terror and death, and if you stare at it, you'll be healed. Gawk at judgment and then be free of judgment. It's a fascinating story. And after that verse, it totally wraps up. Meaning, there's no interpretation given in Numbers 21. No postscript that says, by the way, Moses saying, I know this was a little weird, but here's what it meant. There's no explanation of this is what the story means, or if you ever want to get healed in the future, just build an ugly statue and you'll get healed. Or if you complain against God, he'll whack you every time in the exact same way. Or if you pray, you'll always be healed. No commentary, just a weird story. And there have been two interpretations given to this story. The first is semi-helpful. The second is endlessly helpful. The first comes to us through the rabbinic tradition. The rabbinic tradition considered this story, just like it did the near sacrifice of Isaac, Abraham's son Isaac. They've given this a lot of thought. And that rabbinic tradition inspired a psychoanalyst named Carl Jung to do a lot of digging in this passage. This was his favorite passage from the Old Testament. And he believed that this text is about how individuals are healed psychologically. Now, there's some wisdom here. What he says is, the only way that you're ever going to upend a pattern in your family that's dark and dismal, the only way you're going to deal with your serious sin, is you have to name it as such. You have to look at something in your life through articulated speech. So you drag it out of you. You put it on a pole, so to speak, and say, this is a massive crisis in my life, and I keep getting walloped because of it. I need to name it for what it is and judge it as sin and look at it. And if you look at it, that will open up doors to healing. Jung had this great phrase. He said, what you resist persists. What you resist persists. Meaning that if you resist looking at the very serious problems in your life, not only will they carry on, they will rule you. They will be like little dark deities that rule you. And so he thought the only way to have a breakthrough is to name the damaging thing, externalize it via articulation, put it on a pole, and then the healing can begin. Robert Downey Jr. made a similar comment. Of course, Carl Jung to Robert Downey Jr., of course, at an award show that he was presenting Mel Gibson, who got in trouble because of all sorts of drunkenness / anti-Semitism. I mean, it was really complicated. But Robert Downey Jr. was trying to revitalize Mel Gibson's career on stage, and so he was presenting Mel with this award, and he was reminding Mel and everybody else of his own checkered past and how Mel helped him out at one point. So he says of Mel Gibson, Mel told me that if I accepted responsibility for my errors and addiction, and if I embraced that part of my soul that was ugly, and if I, great phrase, hugged the cactus, I'd become a man of humility and my life would take on new meaning. In other words, the way that you heal is that you actually have to start admitting that you need to heal. And that there are massive, massive reservoirs of pain and sin within your own life that you need to take responsibility for and stop blaming other people for them. That's the way toward healing. That's how Jung read this text. And I think that's true, true enough, and yet not true enough. Because there is another interpretation. And this one comes by a much more intelligent source whom we know as Jesus of Nazareth. Because Jesus of Nazareth knew that the bronze serpent is not ultimately about the Jews. It's not ultimately about you. It's not ultimately about grumbling nor grumbling's consequences. It's about someone else. Just like the near sacrifice of Isaac was about someone else. We know that this bizarre story figured enormously in Jesus' own imagination because he quotes it three times during his ministry. He says this in John chapter 3. Just as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so must the Son of Man be lifted up, that is on the cross, that he might draw all people to himself. So when Jesus saw this bizarre story with the hideous snake that was lifted in the wilderness, and if people looked on the judgment, they would be free of judgment, he said, that's going to be me. That's a picture of my life, my vocation, my ending. I will be the mediating instrument suspended in the air between heaven and earth, put on a pole as a symbol of judgment against sin, but the judgment falls upon me. Jesus is essentially saying, I will identify as the snake man, the image that people associate with evil and poison and death. This is why St. Paul later in the New Testament can write about Jesus, he who knew no sin became sin so that we might become the righteousness of God. Friends, sin makes us hideous. It deforms us. And Jesus was willing to become the sign of hideousness. The only one who didn't deserve to be was willing to take that on, becoming the Medusa of sorts, associating himself with the power of the snake, with the judgment of God. And so this is a story that predicts, in a way, an even darker story. The story of the withering Son of Man upon the cross. Whatever we make of the Christian religion, we cannot think of it as glitzy, cheap, and like a happy mirage. Those who prefer a sunnier religion and think that faith ought to have a positive, they think faith should have a positive focus and help us to positively improve our already fairly positive lives in light of positive suggestions that increase our overall positive sense of self. By the way, some forms of Christianity seem to favor this more positive version of spirituality. There's a Hallmark form of Christianity with like glossy calendars with pictures of daffodils and Bible verses, or Thomas Kincaid paintings. This type of Christianity sometimes includes endless tales of personal victory without setbacks. It often has a laser-like focus upon healings and deliverances, or places the bulk of our hopes on some sort of political deliverance or cultural acceptance. This is a sunnier vision of Christianity, always promising victory. But this sunny Christianity, which is about creating winners who win, has a Jesus whose primary mission is simply to help winners win more often. Positive, shiny, happy people. But enter the bronze serpent, right? And the crucified Christ and the theology of the cross. This brutal, ugly, garish cross that says, you are not the hero of your own story. You're in fact the villain. But we live within this wild kingdom in which even villains are treasured and cherished and taken home and forgiven and made into family. This is the serious blood-red ground of our faith. We as Christians do not place trust in naive optimism nor in some abstract amoebic God out there somewhere who shows up once in a while to give us sunny days during summer vacations at the Jersey Shore. No. In fact, faith, real faith, looks at the real God who was really agonized in blood-sodden clothes and flesh, the God who was hinged to a crooked cross. There is all beauty and glory and honor in the one who was twisting away in pain, stuck into Middle Eastern wood. This is what the prophet Isaiah predicts in his 53rd chapter when he writes, surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. Yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace. And by his wounds, we are healed. We are healed. He's the one we stare at. We don't stare at glitz and glamour. We certainly don't stare at ourselves or our own incremental improvement. No, we stare at the crucified one. And so my charge to you today is believe in that one, that hideous, beautiful man writhing on the cross. Repent toward that scandal. suspended between heaven and earth. For what you find upon that cross is enough to cover a multitude of sins. Indeed, all the sins you've got. Amen.
Free at last, they took your life. They could not take your life.